Hey everybody, it's Brock Falk, and I want to thank you for listening to this message from Heritage Church of Christ. We would be thrilled to share more content like this with you and make it easy for you to share it with others. You can find more messages like this on our podcast, or you can download our smartphone app by searching for Heritage Church of Christ in your app store. But most importantly, I hope this message encourages you to take a next step toward a thriving relationship with Jesus. Enjoy.
Well, let me tell you one more time how thrilled and excited I am to have the opportunity to be able to celebrate Easter with you. And I want to thank all of you for making the time to be here with us. I know some of you traveled. I know some of you are in from out of town. I know some of you are tuning in online, and it absolutely means the world to us that we have the chance to get to spend this time with you. It's Easter Sunday. And as a Christian, if you're already a believer in Jesus, then you know this is our main event. This is the foundational story of our faith. This is the moment when Jesus changes everything. The story that Easter represents is the most powerful story for us. But you may not already be a Christian. You may not be sure where you stand with your opinion, your impression about this story. But even if you're not a Christian, you probably can tell that this day matters. You probably already know that this story matters. And whether you are already aware of every detail, whether you have studied this on your own, studied this for yourself already, or whether you're here because there's going to be a great lunch at Grandma's house this afternoon, I want you to know, number one, we're thrilled you're here. Number two, I want you to know about the power of this story. You know, as humans, we're drawn to power. We're attracted to power. And the reality is that we are surrounded by different demonstrations of power everywhere we go. In fact, there's a lot of examples of extreme power that surround us every day, things that we have come to think of as commonplace and we hardly even notice them. Because chances are, if you live in this area, there was a moment this week when you drove within just a few feet of an 18-wheeler, hundreds and hundreds of horsepower. Or there's a good chance that you waited at a train crossing as a locomotive with thousands and thousands of horsepower chugged along the tracks. There was a moment earlier this week, my daughter and I were on the back porch and talking with each other, and we had to pause our conversation as a jet flew over with thousands and thousands of pounds of thrust. And it was impossible for us to even hear each other or hear ourselves think. We were surrounded. We were overcome with the power of that machine. But if you think even bigger than that, if you think back to some of the natural demonstrations of power that you have seen, the things that have caught your attention and even taken your breath away, maybe it was a moment sitting at the seashore and listening and watching as the power of the waves came rolling in over and over and over. Maybe there's been a moment when you got to see in person a waterfall like Niagara Falls, and you tried to imagine just the magnitude of all of the power that was on display. Or maybe you can remember one of those moments when a severe thunderstorm blew through your area and the lightning struck so close you wondered if your house might be damaged. And then it was immediately followed by that clap of thunder. And even as a full-grown adult, you thought, that's pretty scary. That's a lot of power. And that's the kind of power that we are exposed to all the time. But there are even more formidable types of power. And we see evidence of this. We're all too aware of the kind of power that people can make for themselves in the political arena or the financial arena. We're all too aware of the kind of power that people can hold over us emotionally, power that can linger, power that can have an impact on us for decades and decades, and it can continue. And we all know that most of humanity, most people, spend their lives struggling and clawing and grasping at opportunities to have more power. In fact, the saga of human history, the entirety of our human experience, it's a series of story after story after story of one person or one nation, one tribal group, one people trying to take and harness power. And more often than not, there's a reciprocal group, a complementary group that's trying to keep that people from gaining too much power. The thing about power is, the thing that attracts us to power is that we imagine what we could do with it if it was ours. We imagine, when we think about power, when we think about harnessing horsepower, we think about what we could accomplish. We think about what we could have. We think about what we could prevent. We think about what we could force to be true. And every human story contains elements of the chase and the pursuit of power. Now, this Easter story, this story that we're observing together today, this story we're remembering, it's a power story. In fact, it's got all of the classic elements of a power play story. There's an existing power structure, and in this story, we're talking about the leaders in Jerusalem, the political leaders, the religious leaders. We're talking about the existing power structure and how they used every powerful tool at their disposal to try to put down what they saw as an uprising, an insurrection. And history has seen this scenario play itself out time and time again. You can look in the news this week and see very similar stories. But here's the thing about the Easter story. The Easter story doesn't follow the same script as all of the rest of those human episodes. The Easter story doesn't end up with the same result because the Easter story reveals a different type of power. I want to set the stage here for you. We're going to look quickly, a flyover, at some of the significant events that happened during this epic power struggle in the final week of Jesus' life before His crucifixion. We're just going to touch on a few details. And I'll get you caught up. If you've never heard the story, I think you'll be able to understand where we are. But I want to invite you to something. That if you've never read this for yourself, if you've never actually read the words of this story yourself, you could download the Heritage app on your smartphone in just a few moments and look at Luke 22, 23, and 24. It'd take you about 12, maybe 15 minutes to read the whole thing because you owe it to yourself to explore the details, the significance of this particular story. So as I set this up, I want you to know that by the time Jesus arrived in Jerusalem, as we discussed last week, by the time Jesus showed up on the scene in the capital city, He was already a wanted man. He already had a target on His back. The people of influence, the religious leaders in Jerusalem, they were tired of hearing the teaching of this renegade rabbi. They were tired of hearing about how incredible he was when he obviously didn't respect the religion that they held so dear. They were tired of the audacious claims that he made about being the Son of God. They resented his lack of respect for their traditions and for their leadership, and they didn't approve of the people with whom he kept company. As far as the religious leaders in Jerusalem were concerned, Jesus was a threat. Jesus was a threat to their authority, a threat to their way of life, a threat to their followers, a threat to their influence, a threat to everything that they held dear. And since they believed he was a heretic, they had grounds to bring charges against Jesus. And so they conspired with one of his followers, a man named Judas. And Judas made plans to keep them apprised of Jesus' whereabouts so that they could strike at just the right moment. And that's exactly what happened. Jesus, who never in his life brandished a weapon, Jesus who never raised his hand to anybody, was arrested by a lynch mob in the middle of the night. And from that moment on, the opponents of Jesus did everything they could. They used every power at their disposal to delegitimize and eventually to destroy Jesus. Here's how it happened. First, they tried to use religious power and influence. They hauled Jesus in front of all of the religious leaders, the council of elders, the high priests, the teachers of their religious law. And they tried to force him to recant the things that he had been saying, the claims that he had been making about himself. And when he wouldn't take back the things that he had said, they decried him as a blasphemer, a heretic, someone whose teaching couldn't be trusted, someone who was obviously a threat. They were building their case. And so then they took him to the Jewish governor of the nearby region. They took him to Herod. And Herod was somebody who was interested in making sure that there was no threat to his own power. And so if somebody was walking around claiming to be the king of the Jews, well, that's got Herod's attention. But as Herod interrogated Jesus, he found no legitimate basis for charges against him. And so the political power that was exerted on to Jesus led to him being taken away and threatened with military power. He was taken before Pilate, the Roman governor of that entire region. Pilate was somebody who didn't care about Jewish affairs. He wasn't worried about their religion. He wasn't worried about how things were going for the people. The one thing he was concerned about was keeping the peace, because it was his job to make sure that nothing in Palestine, nothing in Israel happened that would cause problems for the emperor or for the empire. And so when the Jewish leaders said, "This is the man who has a following of people and he encourages them not to pay their taxes," well, then they had Pilate's attention. Pilate interrogated Jesus. But he didn't give them the answer that they wanted. And they continued to pester Pilate. They continued to beg and plead. They continued to make their case. And they said, if you don't let us execute this man, it's going to continue to be a problem. And finally, Pilate relented. And Pilate's men took Jesus away. And that's when the power of physical force took over. Jesus was beaten and he was mocked. He was ridiculed. He was stripped naked. He was whipped. He had a crown of thorns placed on his head. He was bloody and bruised. He was forced to carry heavy weight. He was forced to travel long distance. The power of physical force took a toll on Jesus all the way to Golgotha, where he was nailed to a cross so that the weight of his body would eventually cause his energy to be completely wiped out. His side was pierced with a spear, and eventually he died. And that was the end result of all of the hatred that was hurled at Jesus. That was the sum total effect of the religious power, the political power, the military power, the emotional power, and the physical power that was all directed at Jesus to keep him from being a threat to the traditions of his people. And throughout the entire ordeal, as every stage happened, as every one of those moments of power being aimed at Jesus happened, Jesus increasingly looked more and more powerless. Jesus, as the process was carried out, Jesus looked more and more ineffective. And his followers began to distance themselves, and they started to wonder, have we placed our hope in the wrong person? And so by the time that Jesus was buried in the tomb after his death on Friday afternoon, all of Jesus' disciples had been convinced that they had been misled, that they had been mistaken. And it appeared at that moment that the opponents of Jesus had won. But then something happened. On Sunday morning, these women who had been devoted Jesus' followers and simply wanted to honor who he was took with them spices and perfumes to anoint Jesus' body. In Luke chapter 24, it says that when they got there, they found the stone rolled away from the entrance of the tomb. But when they went in, they didn't find the body of the Lord Jesus. And they didn't know what to make of this. Suddenly, two men who were standing beside them in gleaming, bright clothing, these two men caused the women to be frightened. And the women bowed their faces toward the ground, but the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He isn't here, but has been raised." And this was the moment when power was flipped on its ear. This was the moment when everything changed. This is the moment when the tables were completely turned, because Jesus had risen from the dead after his opponents had thrown everything at him that was at their disposal, after they had wielded all of their power to silence Jesus, and when they thought that he was gone for good, he did something that nobody else had ever done. He walked out of the tomb. He walked out of the grave. And that changed everything. You see, when Jesus was raised from the dead, it proved that there is a spiritual reality beyond what we can see. When Jesus was raised from the dead, it proved that God the Father affirmed the work and the life and the ministry and the teaching of Jesus the Son. When Jesus was resurrected from the dead, it validated all of Jesus' prior teaching and miracles. When Jesus was resurrected from the dead, it authenticated the meaning of the crucifixion that had happened on Friday afternoon. When Jesus was raised from the dead, it verified that God's power is not threatened by any human power. And when Jesus walked out of that grave, it proved that God's plans cannot be foiled by human resistance. You see, Jesus entrusted Himself to the power of God. Jesus was aware of all of the different types of power that His opponents held. Every threat, every risk, every danger that they could wield. He knew about the power that His opponents had in their hands, but He also knew about the power of God. And Jesus entrusted Himself to the power of God. He didn't resort to violence. He didn't resort to anger. He didn't resort to hatred, even though violence is powerful. Anger is powerful, and hatred is powerful. But Jesus didn't resort to those things because none of those things compare to the power of God. The power that God makes available to those who trust Him. And so this resurrection, this walking out of the grave, this was the result of Jesus' trust in the power of God. And when that happened, when Jesus walked out of the grave, it flipped a script. It changed the narrative, it changed the story, and it changed the future. Because suddenly, the followers of Jesus, who just moments before had been entirely hopeless, who had given up on everything that they had invested all of these months and years in, suddenly these followers of Jesus were emboldened. They were inspired as they imagined the possibilities for someone who couldn't even be defeated by death. That changes things. And it wasn't long before this ragtag group of men and women who had abandoned all hope in Jesus on Friday were suddenly preaching His name boldly in public spaces to anybody who would listen, because the resurrection had changed everything. It had flipped the script. These people staked their lives on the reality of the resurrection that they had witnessed and the promise that death doesn't have power over those who trust in God. Which brings us to you and me. Because the thing about the Easter story is we commemorate this every year. We dress up. There's festivities, there's food, bunnies and eggs, and all of the other trappings that go along with this celebration. But this is so much more than just a commemoration of something that happened long ago. This is so much bigger than just trying to keep the memory alive of something from the past. The Easter story is a reality that we are invited to live into. Jesus is inviting us to make this radical shift in the way that we think about power. Now, You know that if I only trust the things I can see, if I make all the decisions about the trajectory of my life and the priorities of my time and the way I spend my resources, if I make all of those decisions based on what I can see, what I can perceive, what my feelings tell me to do, then I'm going to spend my whole life trying to secure earthly power. And I'm talking about the kind of power that we use to impose our will on other people. The kind of power that we use to tell other people what we want them to do and to say, I'm not going to do that for you. I'm talking about political power. I'm talking about emotional power. I'm talking about mechanical power and physical power and military power and financial power. All of the different kinds of power that humanity chases to try to make things go our way. If we make all of our decisions based on what we can see, then we'll spend our lives chasing more power. And we'll be tempted to use power the way that the opponents of Jesus used power. When the stakes are high, we'll be tempted to take the same kind of shortcuts to our preferred future that the opponents of Jesus took. They used coercion. They used hatred. They used violence. And eventually used murder to be able to get the results that they wanted because the stakes were that high. But Jesus is inviting us into this life that rejects coercion. This life that rejects hatred. This life that rejects violence. Jesus is inviting us to look at the evidence of the resurrection and to believe that God's way, which is the way of peace, is better. There's a letter in the New Testament portion of your Bible. And one of the earliest Christian missionaries, a guy named Paul, wrote this letter to some brand new Christians in the city of Ephesus. And what he said to them is, he said, I'm praying that you'll be able to better understand what resurrection makes possible. He said, I pray that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of glory, will give you a spirit of wisdom and revelation that makes God known to you. Now, these people already know who God is. These people are already believers. They're already disciples. They're already committed. But Paul's praying for them that they would truly come to know the fullness of God. And he goes on. He says, I pray that the eyes of your heart will have enough light to see what is the hope of God's call. I pray that the eyes of your heart will have enough light to see what is the richness of God's glorious inheritance among believers. And then this is the part I wanted you to see. I pray that the eyes of your heart would have enough light to see what is the overwhelming greatness of God's power that is working among us believers. He says, this power is conferred by the energy of God's powerful strength. God's power, real power, ultimate power, was at work in Christ when God raised him from the dead and sat him at God's right side in the heavens. And he goes on, but the prayer, the hope, the desire is that you, as a follower of Jesus, somebody who's investigating and trying to aim yourself toward the priorities that Jesus established, that you would look at the reality of the resurrection and realize that that same power is available to you. It's not a power you have to chase. It's not a power you have to try to attain. It's not a power that you have to pursue. This is a power that God has already delivered to you and made available. And the prayer is, Paul's prayer, my prayer, is that you could see it, that you could know it. You see, Paul's great hope was that these converts wouldn't just live by the same old script, that they wouldn't just add a little bit of Jesus onto the life that they were already living and go about the same pursuits and the same priorities and the same convictions that they already had. Paul's dream was that they would inherit and realize a new script, Because the old script tells us to live for ourselves. The old script says live for the moment. The old script says fight for your rights. Stand up for yourself and defend yourself by whatever means necessary. That's the old way that we all know how to live. But Jesus flips the script. Jesus changes the story, and the new script says, live with joy as you live for the sake of others. The new script says, be kind and patient and self-controlled, even in the face of evil. The new script tells us that love is the way to peace and that gentleness is what power really looks like. And so, today on Easter Sunday, as we send you out to your celebration and to your engagement with the world around you, as you leave this place, I'm going to ask you to leave with a question in mind. And the question is this: what script is controlling your life? Which narrative are you living into? Is it the narrative that says might makes right? Or is it the narrative that says God is calling us to something higher, something greater? There's two competing narratives that played out in this Easter story. The narrative of those who were seeking power and control and trying to maintain authority for themselves, people like the religious leaders, the high priest, Caiaphas, Judas, Pilate, Herod, they all had a narrative that said, let's hold on to what we have. Let's defend what we have. Let's use every bit of power that is at our disposal to put down this uprising. There's one other thing that those people had in common. Caiaphas, Judas, Pilate, and Herod, they're all dead. But Jesus is alive. Jesus is alive because of the narrative that he lived into. Jesus is alive because of the script that he chose. And the Easter question for you today is, which script do you choose? Everybody we know who followed that old script is dead. But Jesus is alive. And I think that makes the choice pretty easy.